Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 437, April the 11th, 1980, side one of the tape. I'm going to try to eliminate the music. I don't know whether it's a hindrance, whether it helps or interferes. I only use it as a lead for the beginning and end to make sure that none of the tape was cut off. I'll allow the same amount of time at each end, but for a few weeks I'll try this and see if we can do without the music. It does take a lot of extra time, and see how we go with just straight news and no music. There's a local group here that has various people lecturing or speaking with them once a week on current subjects, and they invited me to speak next week on a topic that I thought was of importance to the news. I could choose any subject I wanted, and the title of the speech that I'm going to share with them, the information, is this: Is America a Captured Nation? Now, a lot of you who have taken the tapes for a long time know how I feel about the United States of America. In essence, I believe that as soon as World War II was over, certain persons in our State Department, like John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, the Rockefellers, the multinational corporations, ITT, and many of the large industries of the United States, were very sorry that the Soviet Union had been our ally. We had pumped Adolf Hitler up as our bulwark against communism to fight the Soviet Union, and he lost that battle in 1943, and at that time the decision was made to entrench the top aides of Adolf Hitler and that team into the American intelligence apparatus, and when war was formally over by 1945, the Nazis, headed under Reinhard Gehlen, the chief of Hitler's Eastern Division and Intelligence, began to form our National Security Council and our Central Intelligence Agency. And since that time, everything that has been done in the United States, every major decision and policy, has been to the detriment of the United States and has made Japan, Germany, the Netherlands stronger nations, even Great Britain and France, and the United States has become weaker all the time. We've become the bullies, the assassins, until we're at the point where we're morally, psychologically, economically, and politically totally bankrupt. And furthermore, I don't know if we can afford any more continuous assassinations because of the payoffs, the extortion, the blackmail that I'll get into later. But this country is a disgrace. People all over the world know what we have done and watch us. And we're divided in so many sections, and that was part of Hitler's plan to take America, was to divide us up into many segments and have the segments fight each other. In a book called Blackmail, M-A-I-L, by Henry Hoke, an excellent book published in 1944, he has a quotation of Adolf Hitler that was distributed around the United States in 1940, and this was what Adolf Hitler wrote. He said, in quotes, "America is permanently on the brink of revolution. It will be a simple matter for me to produce unrest and revolts in the USA. These gentry will have their hands full with their own affairs. National socialism alone is destined to liberate the American people from the ruling clique. I shall undertake the task simultaneously with the restoration of Germany to her leading position in America." And he goes on to separate the segments, the office holders versus the taxpayers, the native-born versus the foreign-born, the rich against the poor, labor versus management, the young against the old, the colored against the white, Gentiles against Jews, the North against the South, the Easterners against the West, the Democrats against the Republicans, conservatives against the liberals, and the Protestants against the Catholics. And when you take these battle lines and you put them into manila files and folders and you watch these elements fight each other, and even the researchers just on the Kennedy assassination, those that disguised as researchers who are spies, and those who are honest researchers, are pitting the two honest researchers against each other, or even the spies against each other. Adolf Hitler knew that there were all these elements in this country that were clawing each other from the time this country began. And he doesn't even go into the Indians that were put down, or the Chicanos and the Mexican-Americans, and the COINTEL programs, the criminal conspiracy sections of the police department. They followed. Those were the work of Adolf Hitler. But he listed the groups that could be separated, that are interlocking segments that could be separated in order for Germany to be powerful and take the United States of America. And in my speaking about Are We a Captured Nation, I will refer briefly to books like Sabotage. I've had that on the tapes for you, The Great Conspiracy, The Nazis Go Underground, The Plot Against the Peace, School for Spies, The Nazi Octopus in South America, The Mufti and the Fuhrer, Armies of Spies, and I've now collected 600 or 700 books just on this subject, on how we got into the quagmire we're in today. Before I get on to abscam and conspiracies, though, I just want to give a few quotations. One, an example of the terrible position America's in, because I could take 40 headlines from this week and go over them with you, but just one tells the story, really. But there's a book review that sums up Henry Kissinger. A brief book review came out in the Los Angeles Times in November of 1979 on Henry Kissinger's book, The White House Years. And the book review is by George McGovern. And I want to just share a couple sentences of that review, because I don't think people really catch on. They think that Kissinger's errors were honest errors that blundered, or the Congress fortunately stopped him. They don't realize that the one step after Kissinger, the Nazi running National Security Council and State Department, comes in Brzezinski, another Polish Nazi who gets one step further and actually involves us with troops in the Middle East at this time. McGovern said, "For 10 years I've been appalled by Mr. Kissinger's views on the horrible tragedy his policies helped to perpetuate in Indochina. The elaborate rationalization of this incredible nightmare that Kissinger lays out in his memoirs only widens the gap between my personal affection for him and my dismay over his part in the still unfolding Holocaust of Indochina." And then George McGovern said, "As for his worldview, Mr. Henry Kissinger is, I would believe, unwittingly sentenced, he would sentence the United States to a slow decline in influence and leadership. He places our power in opposition to the revolutionary forces that have been convulsing and developing the world since 1945. He pitted us against every government that was trying to effect some kind of change, and by not being able to change any other way, they have become revolutionary." McGovern said, "In Kissinger's view, America's greatness would survive only if we had the will to play an imperial role in global affairs. He would have used whatever military power was required to smash Indochina to its knees, nor do I doubt that he would have used American might to order events in Africa to his own liking. He would use the muscle of the United States to deploy and save the Shah of Iran, which was already a fait accompli. The people didn't want him, and he would have sent troops in for Somoza and Nicaragua. There are many other Americans who yearn to see Uncle Sam boldly assume that role of policeman for the world. I see that role as an obsolete fantasy that, if employed, would spell frustration, defeat, and eventually exhaustion for the United States. Now, I say we're morally, financially, politically bankrupt, and the Kissinger-Brzezinski policy has brought us to the edge of frustration, defeat, exhaustion, and there won't be anything left of this country, guided by the Polish and the German Nazis running the National Security Council and the State Department." The article I'm referring to that is the epitome of the stupidity we can get into without any brains about how to get out of these problems was one of the New York Times this week. "The Navy is feeling the strain in Indian Ocean." That's the title of the article. Imagine the United States Navy is feeling the strain and they haven't even gone to war yet. There are 2 aircraft carriers, 16 other warships, 8 supply vessels, and an 1,800-man marine amphibious force sitting in the Indian Ocean. Jimmy Carter escalated that when the hostages were taken in Iran and the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan. And now the head of the Defense Department, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown, and Admiral Thomas Hayward, Chief of Navy Operations, are saying that the Navy faces severe difficulties if the fleet is kept in the Indian Ocean, that the Mediterranean is weak, the Pacific Ocean is weak, the morale of the crewmen is terrible. Some have been there more than 100 days, and they say staying in the Indian Ocean will exacerbate the services already that has serious problem retaining skilled crewmen. They're having difficulties keeping them going. The sheer cost of the support system there is terrible. It's cost $1 billion so far. They can't afford to finance this. The fuel is expensive. And the mission has, in quotes, stretched its capabilities. It stretched the American Navy. Now, when we had war in Southeast Asia, it was hard on the Americans to go there, to go into the jungles. But even in that ghastly war, when they were flown over, there was a native population, there were women, joints, sex, beer, saloons, and some simulation of the things that they needed or were used to at home. They're over in a territory where they're not prepared. They were trained at places like the Mojave Desert, and after training they could go into Barstow and get their recreation and cool off and have a smoke and see people that they knew. Now they're in a territory where the women are veiled, where there's no middle class, where slave labor is kept in concentration camp areas in Saudi Arabia, brought in from South Korea, where if they land, there's no drinks, there's no women, there's severe punishments if they're caught with any of these activities. They are kept hostages on boats outside a place which is costing a fortune and which can't possibly bomb oil fields and survive, and all of our fleet, or a good hunk of it, are sitting there like Pearl Harbor, almost like waiting for a kamikaze to blow them up, and they're impotent. They can't move one way or the other, which is what I said would happen last November when the men were taken hostages. I called it to reach the apex of American power, and from there we decline. But the situation there with these men, as I say, there's no wine, there's no women, it's hot, it's going into summer, we don't have enough ships elsewhere, they're running out of fuel, the cost is tremendous. We can't afford to fight, and we can't afford to keep them there, and besides that, the men psychologically are going bananas. That is just one sample of the kind of problem that you are probably reading and I'm reading, but which is so typical of the blundering of people like Jimmy Carter, who are living back their mind way, way back at a time where they could send ships out and think it would scare somebody. Nobody is scared by the American fleet, and the actual people there will not be able to function normally, even in a time of battle, probably, it goes on to say, because they're beginning to malfunction psychologically and emotionally from the isolation of sitting in a hot place like that on a ship and not going anywhere. The subject of the Nazification of America is interesting, and there's a new book out by Charles Hyman called Errol Flynn, The Untold Story, and it's the story of Errol Flynn, the movie star, working for the Gestapo, a traitor to the United States government. And Mr. Hyman has been doing interviews, radio talk shows about this book, and he was on KGO Radio in San Francisco, and Owen Spann was the moderator. And I called up to make the point that the Errol Flynn, the actor, is long gone, but the people that worked with Errol Flynn in the Bahamas and the Montego Bay, Monte Carlo, London, Mexico, are still alive and are part of the Nazi network that were involved in the killing of John Kennedy, and they were involved in the Watergate operations and are in power today. At that point, Owen Spann, the moderator, this is ABC-owned station out here, hung up immediately and said to Mr. Hyman on the air, "Oh, these crazies always call and bring in these assassinations." So I called Charles Hyman. I took a chance at where he was staying and called him and spoke to him and shared some information about Errol Flynn and the linking of the Nazis. But the important point I wanted to make about my conversation with him was his surprise at the reaction to his promoting this book. His father was a member of Parliament in Great Britain. He's an American citizen now. And he remembered the bombings in London during the war. And he can't imagine why, when you say somebody is a Nazi and a traitor to the free world or democracy, why people are turning against him and angry. The Hearst paper put down his book. And, of course, I explained the role of Randolph Hearst, putting Hitler into power and supporting the Nazi regime and all the fascist organizations after that. And the media has been trying to put him down, and talk show people are antagonistic to him. And what I said was, rearrange your head, Mr. Hyman, about the way the world is today. This is a captured nation, and the Nazis won. And you are speaking out there to an audience as if you were in Poland in 1939, in, say, September the 1st, before the Nazis invaded, and you're saying the Germans are coming, the Nazis are coming. They would resent you because they don't like the communists, and in 24 hours after Adolf Hitler invaded Poland, the network was set for Poland to collapse. Or put yourself in France in 1940, talking about Adolf Hitler and talking about the Nazis, when all the press and all the government were pro-Adolf Hitler and had secretly made deals so that when Hitler came into France within 24 hours, it would fall. And what I explained is that we are a captive nation, and you're trying to appeal to logic or reason, whereas people today want to go to war against Russia. They want that Third World War, and Hitler will come out the hero of the 20, 30, and 40s and 50s, because he warned us about Russia, and we waited too long to go in to get Russia to get him. Never a word about peace or the alternatives, the way we could run the world with peace. The main thing is to keep the war machine going in every sense of the word. Mr. Hyman and I shared some beliefs about Simon Wiesenthal. I never understood why Wiesenthal only settled for the Jew Eichmann to be caught in South America, never going after Mengele's Bormann or 20 or 30,000 other Nazis around the world. And Mr. Hyman shared a story about being in Germany and wanting to speak to a party who was involved with Errol Flynn and the Gestapo. I believe that was the relationship. And Mr. Wiesenthal said that this person was out of town and wasn't there. And the next day, Charles Hyman was able to get in touch with him. He was, in fact, there. I don't trust the whole so-called Holocaust machine. They emphasize the past, they don't look at the present, and they turn their back on to many of the things that those Nazis in Germany are doing today. Not new Nazis, but the old Nazis. But the book sounds very interesting, and Mr. Hyman's done a lot of work, and I think the links, the Monte Carlo connections, the Bahama connections to Ian Fleming, and a lot of the people that I've mentioned on my past tapes, you'll find running through this book. I haven't gotten it yet. I've just seen some very good reviews, or interesting reviews of it, but I think it'll be important to read and connect to some of the other characters that have subverted this country systematically and purposely in the favor of Nazi Germany. There is one paperback book out about Errol Flynn, The Two Lies of Errol Flynn by Michael Friedland. And after hearing Mr. Hyman and talking to him, I got an interest in Errol Flynn. I never really cared much about him before this came out, and I started to read this book just to read a little bit of it, and it tells him about him living in New Guinea and working with British soldiers, and I guess that's where he got his first introduction in New Guinea to a doctor who was to get him into the Nazi and Gestapo war machine. It tells about his murdering a person, murdering a whole group of people, savage activities that he did in New Guinea before he ever got to Hollywood, and some of his brutality on a farm in Australia and so forth. As far as I got in the book, he's really a beast, and this man is trying to write a nice biography about a Hollywood movie star. It's interesting because in that book, he hasn't done any of the work of Errol Flynn to the Gestapo or the war machine, but very early in the book, he describes Flynn's life in New Guinea. And he says exactly what he did thereafter will never be known for certain. The only available evidence is confused. Flynn himself spent the rest of his life talking about New Guinea and his exploits there, but the trouble is he told a different story every time, and it tells, as I say, about his work with Australian and American troops in New Guinea and then his coming to the United States to make films. It leaves out the Nazi connections that come later, but there are a lot of loopholes in Flynn's life, and the author is honest to admit that they're there. Last week I did a tape on Irv Davidson. If you don't have that tape, you'll have to get tape 436. I don't want to repeat and waste time on it, but it's an important tape, and this man, Irv Davidson, is a public relations man in Washington, D.C., who is sort of the octopus, the head of the wheel of an 8-prong conspiracy monster linked to the Kennedy assassination, and one of his prongs is Carlos Marcello of organized crime down in New Orleans, who links to David Ferry, Jack Ruby, Clay Shaw, and Clay Shaw links to Reinhard Gehlen and the Nazi agents and the Solidaris, what's known as the Vaslov's army, the White Russians, and so forth. And Davidson is a very important man. His name came out in the Washington Post April the 2nd, 1980, with a large article. There were smaller ones at the time of the Abscam leaks. The story broke. There are no arrests except for two men in immigration department so far. But this is an important man, Mr. Davidson, and he's important because Carlos Marcello, mentioned in this article in the Washington Post that I had last week, was the link of Abscam, the northern organized crime, CIA connections of New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., South Carolina, and Miami, to the Bri-Lab, the bribery labor, linking the Southwest, Beverly Hills, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and the New Orleans. The common denominator between Bri-Lab and Abscam, as I mentioned last week, was Carlos Marcello of organized crime. And what I said was that those researchers who feel gloomy about the Kennedy assassination don't have to worry, because the story would be breaking eventually. Truth is on our side. If time isn't on our side, truth is there. So stay healthy, and let's get the story out in the open. But just after I made my tape last week, there was an article that should do the researchers' hearts good, put out by Jack Anderson. It was in our Monterey Herald. The San Francisco Chronicle deleted this part of the Jack Anderson article, and I'm going to read it to you, all four sentences, because I've been researching the Kennedy assassination since November 22, 1963. Mark your calendar, April the 2nd, 1980, the beginning of the breakthrough of the Kennedy assassination. And I mentioned Jack Anderson last week because he rented property, an office space, from this Irv Davidson, who was so important. Jack Anderson also has worked with Frank Sturgis and many people involved in the Kennedy assassination and in Watergate story. That was Frank Fiorini in Miami during the days when Jack Kennedy was killed and Frank Sturgis was allegedly at Dealey Plaza the time that Kennedy was killed. His role has never been defined. But Jack Anderson had an article, and this is what it said in black letters, and maybe I'll copy it for you, put it on the sheets this week. It's so important. Kennedy probe. While it is Abscam and Bri-Lab scandals that have been making headlines, the FBI is quietly digging into another explosive assignment, the assassination of John Kennedy. The House Assassination Committee turned over to the Bureau its findings that Kennedy was probably killed as a result of a conspiracy, contrary to the conclusion of the Warren Commission 16 years ago. FBI agents have been talking to former committee aides seeking guidance for the use of the committee files in the National Archives. Agents have asked the authors of some of the committee studies for the location of documents cited in footnotes. Now, I'm not talking about the Justice Department going into the tape of the firing of that fourth bullet, that headshot that killed John Kennedy. Jack Anderson said the Bureau has consulted the CIA on retesting the controversial acoustical evidence of a fourth shot that was fired at Kennedy that day in Dallas. Now, Jack Anderson, in his usual style, would say that the FBI is quietly digging into another blind alley of the Kennedy assassination, or he would paraphrase it, after two expensive investigations, the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee, the FBI is lost in a tunnel on the Kennedy. No, he said they're in an explosive assignment, the assassination of John Kennedy. And he uses it while the Abscam and Bri-Lab scandals are going and making the headlines, the FBI is going there. Now, as the government began to investigate counterfeit money, forgeries, stolen art, bank robberies, blackmailing, extortion, prostitution, pornography, security exchange payments, payoffs, all kinds of wheeling and dealing and skimming, Eventually, it leads them right to the Kennedy assassination. When the CIA was formed after World War II, and before the CIA, the OSS, was in operation during World War II, the end of World War II in Italy, Lucky Luciano was incorporated into the intelligence community, then brought home to the men to watch the docks in New York City and elsewhere in Marseille. And this strange marriage of CIA to Nazis and CIA to organized crime eventually has to break open, and it's breaking everywhere at the seams. Those gloomy researchers can be very happy now, because it will, the story will come out in pieces and pieces. And no matter how hard we researchers work, it's not going to come down the way you think it is. It's going to come down by somebody like Mr. Irv Davidson being wiretapped for a year and working with Carlos Marcellus and so forth. It's going to come down from some informer or person who's telling them things. You know, only 200 people were killed that were primary witnesses to the Kennedy assassination. But there are 200 to 300 more who have very important pieces of the information that would bring this country to its knees. And when Jack Anderson begins to say that there's an explosive investigation going on, it's a trial balloon. It's out there, and that means get ready. It's going to become bigger. It's like he's taking the IGT memo of Dita Baird that broke open the whole Watergate story months later. You can be sure that this story will eventually unfold if Jack Anderson is talking about the FBI investigation and its possible links to Bralab and the Abscam. Because the minute those men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel in June 17, 1972, I said it goes back to the Kennedy assassination. And as soon as there were the leaks in the New York Times and Newsday about Abscam and Carlos Marcello, I said, okay, this goes to Watergate, the John Kennedy assassination, and then as the other investigations came, I knew it would all fit together. So there's a very thunderous silence in the news media about MIPOR, Brilab, Abscam, and the other investigations, because so many people are in the pay of organized crime. But there are many people who aren't going to want to go to jail, and in return for immunity, they're going to talk. There was a time when I was able to file the articles I want and get my hands on them. With these new investigations coming, the articles on organized crime, mobsters, drug arrests, and current trials are getting into the news and are very, very important, and there's no way that I'm going to be able to keep you up on all the details. I have one pile of articles here called Crime Articles, Trials, Arrests, to separate and to put in separate files, and I must have at least 100 articles from the news that's come to me this past week from what I take and what other people send. I have a packet here of deaths unrelated to Abscam, but not certain yet what their connection or importance is. Murders, the president of Liberia, the almost killing of Mrs. Gandhi, deaths from all over, freeway deaths, multiple deaths, strangler in Los Angeles, 35th boy found by the freeway, very important information, and people dying. It's sitting here, a pile of it. Then there is a third pile of Abscam-related deaths, organized crime figures being knocked off. It'd take a computer and an army to file what I've just cut from this week and share with you the significance. There's no way I can do it. I'm frustrated. I'll make sense and give you the best I can each week, but in time it'll fit together if I ever had a staff or a group of people that could separate these. I've separated my articles of the various crime figures, the crime families by name, the current arrests that I have in files, the chronological order of the Abscam murders to put in separate files. I'll do the best I can, but there are many, many people being murdered now, many arrests, and if you take any, say, one-tenth of what are Abscam murders or one-tenth of the deaths that are related to purposeful murders, out of that are going to become people who are going to talk and tell us more of the puzzle. There's just too many people going in the clink that are going to squeal for immunity, and we're going to see a lot of news break about the domestic corruption in the next year. More even than Watergate, because Carter is up to his neck in the narcotic combination, and these people linked to Jimmy Carter and the Georgia connection to the narcotics. And so does Ronald Reagan's team. Paul LaSalt, who manages his team, is from Nevada. He represented the Hughes, the Summa Corporation, the Howard Hughes, which is organized at Resorts International, and the originally the Mary Carter Paint Company, and organized crime and Justice Department. So Both candidates have strong links to organized crime, to assassination teams, to narcotics traffic, and eventually they'll all be caught in the web. Even Frank Sinatra's name was in the news this week for skimming money. He's part of the Reagan campaign. Neither of the candidates is clean in terms of narcotics, drugs, payoff, and narcotics traffic. Now, we're going to go to the other side of this tape without the music. You're used to the music. But we'll just switch to the other side, and I'll begin part two of this tape. It's Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.